Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm your host, Paul David, CEO of Literal Humans. We got a juicy one today. We're talking about innovations in climate tech and specifically ERW, which stands for Enhanced Rock Weathering. And we've got a fantastic guest today calling in from, I believe, Michigan. Is that right, Anna?
Yes.
We're joined today by Anastasia Pavlovic, CEO of ION. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So, you know, first things first, just kind of setting the scene. You run a company called ION. You do sort of enhanced rock weathering to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in the agricultural heartlands in the U.S. Do we have that right? Is that a good summary?
That's right.
There? Sweet. You yourself, you're an electrical and biosystems engineer with extensive experience in sustainable ag and the climate sector. And under your leadership, the company has been named one of Time's top green tech businesses in 2024. Congrats. That's well done.
Thank you.
Time magazine. Thanks. Just a short step to person of the year. We can see it. We can see it.
I can day picture.
By day. Yeah, day by day. That's how we do it. So yeah, you've got very important things to crack on with. So we appreciate you spending your time with us and sharing with our audience. We've not talked about ERW on the pod, so you're sort of popping our cherry on that one, as it were. Let's frame it for the audience here. Climate tech is getting a lot of attention, a lot of funding right now, and you know, most people are probably thinking about renewable energy when they hear climate tech, but there's so much more, and just want to understand like what some of the biggest challenges and opportunities and kind of what's happening in the space right now, I guess, is the broadest question. Like, we're seeing shifts in funding, you know, these new lesser known climate tech technologies rise up. So like, just kind of set the scene for us. Like, we know that European climate tech raised $20 billion in 2023. It matches 2022 levels, but there's something happening globally here. So like, kind of set the scene for our audience if you can.
Absolutely. So I think one of the things I would mention is that over the last few years, you know, when I started looking at the intersection of climate tech and ag in 2018, 2019, many of the investors and people that hopefully are listening, you know, no one was talking about these topics, right? So like, this has changed so much and so fast, which has been really amazing to me. I think the things I would note, investment is definitely up, although the numbers can be weird because of what you pointed out with shifts in how different types of energy are funded and different types of carbonization are funded. So you often have these big growing investments in early stage technologies like rock weathering, which both need to come down in terms of cost and need to do a lot of great scaling so that they can be proven to continue to grow and grow to meet our emissions reduction targets. But then you have things like you pointed out, like renewables, which have moved past venture funding more to project finance and other structures that help them grow at a really mega scale. And so I think it can look, when those are all blended together, like parts of VC investments have gone down in climate tech, which I don't think is totally true. The other thing that we've seen a lot of is that when you look at venture investments across tech, a lot of times climate tech is cobbled together with like a couple other technology capabilities, depending on how the funds are structured. And what we've often seen is that the climate tech portions of companies of those portfolios are performing incredibly well above expectations, while some of those performance across other areas of tech have been kind of flat or more stable. So I think it is growing continually, especially in the new pathways, new technology buckets.
Yeah. So like, and maybe another way to think of it is like, it almost the climate tech sector is like a victim of its own success, right? Like some of these, you know, investments are proving themselves and, you know, they get massive upfront investments, they prove themselves, and then investment, you know, sort of levels out after that. And then we sort of turn to new investments. Is that a good summary?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it will be the same for rock weathering. If we are all successful at the massive scale that we're talking about, when we get to, you know, the projects that are $50, $100, $150 million to fund, those will likely move much more into the project finance the way renewables has, as opposed to being fully venture funded.
Well, take a step back and let's dig into specifically what you do. We had Jonathan Leland from Kickstarter, who touched on enhanced rock weathering in a recent episode. We spoke with him about the voluntary carbon market. We'd love for you to just explain for our audience, like an 8-year-old or something like that, what is ERW? How does it work? What's the impact of ERW on decarbonization? And kind of what are its like use cases and limitations?
Absolutely. So rocks all over the world are weathering. That's a term that, you know, geologists and climate environmental scientists use to describe this process, but it's like erosion. So it's like thinking about if you had a big pile of rocks in your yard, if you could speed up time scale and watch those rocks erode over thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, you know, you would see that end up becoming sediment that would go down into the soils and go through the water columns. And so the idea with enhanced rock weathering, and why it's called enhanced, or some people call it advanced, is that we're able to speed up this process. And what's really amazing about that is that you don't need, there are lots of ideas about how to make it even faster, but in order to just simply speed up the same process that the Earth is doing on every inch of the terrestrial globe now, all you really need to do is increase the particle sizes, the surface area of the particle sizes of rock that we're talking about. And so the idea is that there are certain rocks that are really great at this process. They're really efficient and fast at weathering. And if we can grind up those rocks into like a fine powder, kind of like a sand, we're able to increase the surface area such that that process can happen way faster. And if you can find uses where those products could be used at scale, like agriculture, you have a way to not change a lot of the existing processes of what are happening by farmers or landowners today, get them to use this product, and they're removing carbon from the atmosphere at a really incredible rate. And so it's the most amazing technology, really.
I mean, that sounds really cool. Walk us through, like, how are farmers using are they using the sediment? Are they using the larger, like, how's it work?
So today farmers use, depending on where your farm is, you are likely using some amount of what's called agricultural lime, which is essentially a pH mitigation agent that helps farmers keep the ideal range of pH in their soils that help things like nutrient uptake, water flow. And so they need this ideal range for every one of the processes in their soil system. And so when they get above or below that, they need to find ways to mitigate it. And so they use ag lime, depending on where you are in the country or what the acidity of soils is like historically. That can be anywhere from every year to every 3 years, which is pretty common. And so the idea is, if we could create a product that works as well or even better in a lot of cases because of the rocks we use than ag lime in terms of mitigating pH, the process itself looks exactly the same to the farmer. They get this rock that's kind of like a powdery sand. They use the exact same equipment that they use today to apply ag lime. It's precision applied in a variable rate application, which means that the tractor knows how much to apply and where, like a prescription for the field. And it's applied by a spreader. And so what's really important about that, and we'll talk more about farmers as we go through here, is that fitting into what farmers do today is super important to help them scale. Big operational changes for them are hard, they're expensive, and they're risky. And so more ways we can find to use this special rock, but make it look like something that's very well known and understood, is a huge part of what helps this scale.
Yeah. Curious about, like, there's the you know, this human element. This is why we named our agency Literal Humans, because, like, a lot of these tech challenges and just, like, challenges and everything, it's about the people and the relationships, things like that. So, like, what are your relationships like with farmers, and how are you sort of working with them to achieve massive sequestration of carbon from the atmosphere? Just, like, really, really curious about the people element.
I think it's one of the things I love the most about my job. When I started working on this, I was working on, so ion with rock weathering removes inorganic carbon. That is different than people talking about, you might hear people talking about soil organic carbon, which is another type of carbon that's actually in the organic matter of the soils. And so most regenerative or conservative agriculture, conservation practices, regen ag, people call these different names. Most of the things related to those practices are related to soil organic carbon. That's the world that I came from. When this idea that, like, other industries could help fund the transition to regenerative and conservation practices in agriculture started, these practices have been known for, I've met farmers that have been doing them for 30 years that can show the benefits of them, that are the best advocates. But it wasn't until more recently that we had things like the voluntary carbon markets that were more creative ways to try to figure out how to incentivize these things. And so when the adoption of those voluntary carbon markets as applied to farming got more popular, a lot of farmers were skeptical because they hear things like climate and they hear big tech companies and they think, why are they funding me to do something differently? Like, it was hard for them. The market wasn't explained well. A lot of times people were coming to them with different offers and they didn't really understand all the mechanics of it. And the industry moved so fast. And so in soil organic carbon, there was a lot of distrust with farmers because like they just didn't understand all the elements, and they like, they're shrewd business people. They wanted to understand exactly how this is going to work. I think that's changed because soil organic carbon and the voluntary carbon markets have been playing in this space for a while. And so farmers know, generally any farmer I meet knows way more about this than they did 5 years ago. And so that's been like really amazing to see. But I think one of the most important challenges that I faced is like the people who are paying for and trying to invest in these changes, like companies like Kickstarter, every big tech company you can think of has like an awesome program where they're investing in different types of land. The notions that they're fighting for are sometimes the emotional opposites of the farmer belief system. And so what's so important is that the messages like I always lead with are that we're working on making this a business and like a profitable venture that makes sense for all the players involved. And so you don't have to be an activist to find a practical program that makes sense for you and your farm and your operation. And I think just opening up and talking more, like a huge part of what I've done in ag and in the carbon space is just education. We just need to talk to people and tell them more about it. But it is challenging. You know, I do think things like Inflation Reduction Act and some of the tax crediting mechanisms that are coming out of that have opened farmers' minds in areas that they think about more often that are the good parts of climate incentives, like things that will incentivize them to create low carbon products that go into biofuels. Like that's something that farmers who are doing grain marketing think about every day, and they're realizing that those worlds are coming closer together. So that's been cool to see, but it's hard. It's a challenge. Every day we work on this human side.
What are your top like two or three strap lines for like Joe Farmer? Like you're hanging out in the upper panhandle. What is it?
Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, Upper Peninsula. Sorry. Yeah. And like, and you're like, all right, Joe Farmer, like I'm trying to bring you on this ERW stuff. Like here are my top two or three sort of elevator pitches to you to get you on board. Like, what would you say?
One of the things that has been most beneficial is that it's easy for them to fit into their existing operation, like we talked about earlier, with very little change. And that's important because you start out with, you know, I can provide you a cost savings on this. And so part of the subsidization that we see from the different business models of voluntary carbon markets being one is that it actually allows you to subsidize the cost, whether that be the cost of the product or the cost of labor. So they can see very clearly, oh, there's a value proposition that's going to save me money. I'm listening. Second question they ask is, what do I have to do?
Right? Yeah.
And so okay. In the world of soil carbon, the hardest part about this was that the operational changes that you have to make to transition to conservation practices and things that people associate with regen ag are hard. They take a long time to transition. You can't do your whole farm at once. If we're talking about a farm that's 10,000 acres, that's really challenging. So the second thing, they're thinking about that. They're thinking about massive operational changes, data collection. They want to know exactly what this means. And when you say you're going to get this product, it looks just like the ag lime used today. In fact, a lot of times it's nicer because it's a little bit finer. Sometimes ag lime, depending on where you get it, can be clumpy. You can get issues with crusting. So we've actually heard from farmers, although we don't sell it this way, that like, oh, this product's actually way nicer and it like applied really nicely.
What's ag lime? Just to define it for our audience.
Ag lime is the agricultural limestone that they are purchasing normally to do this. And it's different types of limestones that are usually from quarries that are operating for like materials that go into cements and other types of like mixed products. And so it's kind of like a slag product. So it's not like milled or prepared very finely for them. And that's usually okay because it's not very expensive and they need to use it. So it's okay, but they notice like a difference. And so once you say, this is going to look just like your agricultural lime that you're getting today, but it's probably going to work and be a little bit nicer of a product. And you don't have to change anything else that you're doing. This is going to fit into the soil sampling that you do. You use existing equipment. That's game changing because the value prop and the like need to change are a short conversation that doesn't require. I mean, in some of my big ranches and farms that we worked in regenerative ag, some of our deals took a year to work on the plans to think about operationally changing their farm. And it's a huge undertaking. And so this is really amazing to see how quick farmers get the story.
I want to zoom out a little bit and you know, talk about, like, we obviously just had COP28 that took place in 2023. There's a lot of talk about, like, a lot of resistance, I think, to, like, you know, carbon capture and storage, and obviously, like, a lot of criticism of the voluntary carbon market, and people just kind of, like, skeptical because a lot of the technology, as you said, is, like, somewhat unproven or is increasingly proven, and is sort of, you know, that a lot of investments are going in. And I want to get your take on where you see the carbon capture and storage, you know, slice of the market heading, and you know, why are you bullish on it? And how do we do that sort of education to get folks to say, like, hey, this is a huge slice. We can't get to keeping it to 1.5, you know, C of temperature change without this slice of the market. Like, what would you kind of say to all those, you know, criticism, I guess?
I really liked what Jonathan from Kickstarter said. I very much agree with it. There are very real criticisms. And I think we also owe it to ourselves to say it behooves us because of how massive the climate change targets are and how hard it's going to be to meet those goals that lie ahead of us. We also have to say these are early burgeoning markets where we're not going to have it perfect at first. And so rather than take this sort of perfect be enemy of good, I think we do need to say it's not super surprising that in these, like, really early stages of growing these markets, there are issues, there are things we discover. But as he mentioned, you know, those issues are very real. I think one of the hard things that I've noticed a lot is that people who don't work closely to the sector, if you hear one podcast that's all about how bad all of the stuff in the voluntary carbon markets was related to a certain type of forestry, for example, it's very difficult for you as the listener to discern how blanket that statement is. And the truth is that, like, the devil's in the details, really. There's a lot of precision within the voluntary carbon markets and the sector that goes to defining, like, what the issues were specifically. And different companies have had different issues that they've, you know, that stakeholders and press and stuff have pushed on. So I do think we need to, like, help educate people to understand it better. But I also think we need to take those in stride, figure out how to improve them. New technologies and new companies are going to be developing things coming behind this to improve, because all of these things need to come online faster and more credibly than they are today. And it is not a competition of, like, this pathway is better than that. We need to go way faster and way harder than we are. And we need to, like, bring everybody together in this, like, carbon removal world who's doing this. The other thing we had mentioned was, you know, how do you think about decarbonization? John also explained this really well. How do you think about decarbonization versus these new carbon removal technologies, and that some people think that they are, like, very much at odds? I go back to what I said about the message to farmers. If we are to scale these to the size that we need to even scratch the surface of these climate targets, we have to find ways to make them profitable businesses. That shouldn't be scary. That if anyone can benefit from them, that they're de facto bad is not an assumption that I think we should make.
Yeah, we just had Robin on from Snug. They're a home energy efficiency startup out of Edinburgh. And the way he phrased it just earlier today was saying, like, we need grown up businesses in this industry, like, more so than ever, you know, because, like, we just don't have time to play around and, you know, kind of, like, be in competition. He actually talked about the collaboration and stuff like that, and how willing folks are in the climate tech sector to share. And
it's true.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
It's true. And if we do it right, like, you know, public and private entities come together to find ways that make that scale as fast as possible, I think we're getting there, you know? I mean, it's a long road.
Glad you mentioned scale, because, like, you know, we're a growth strategy agency, marketing, branding, all that good stuff. Like, want to ask about how you're thinking about growth, right? Like, because the urgency is there, right? So, like, how are you thinking about scaling and getting buyers, be they farmers or any other partners, investors and things like that, on board with the cause, you know, that you're pushing for at ION? How are you thinking about, because you have to be a business that scales and scales rapidly to hit these. Not only do you have, like, profit, you know, focus, revenue focus goals, you've got, like, save the world, global SDGs and, you know, all that stuff. Like, how are you thinking about growth differently or innovative ways to get where you want to go?
So one of the things I've been spending a lot of time on, and it makes sense because of my background and, you know, coming from a crop nutrition company that is an industrial, in many ways, a conservative, old school kind of company. I loved your discussion about tempered radicals.
Someone listens to our podcast. Thank you.
I think that when I think about growth, this is a really interesting concept, because right now there are people who are in some of those big tech companies that we talked about, who are doing some of the most amazing work in funding early carbon removal pathways to help them move down the cost curve, figure out what they need to do to get to the next layer and scale. And those entities, you know, in the space, we call them the catalytic buyers. They are critical and they are filling an awesome space. But I think what is also true is that most of the world doesn't look like them. And so most of the world is made up of medium to big companies that have to figure out how the heck they are going to reduce these emissions and what are the levers that they have available to them at what price points. And so the tempered side of me is really thinking about what are the organizations, especially like for, in our case, people who have some sort of scope 3 emissions footprint that touches ag, they are thinking about the agricultural piece and what they can change. But the levers available to them to reduce emissions are small. There are not a lot of them. They're expensive. And so I'm thinking a lot about how do we make something like rock weathering both more common language for people to hear about and think about and consider. I mean, most people I meet when I tell them what I do, they it's like hilarious. And
yeah.
It's like, they're like, huh? But it's real. You yeah. know, we're on farms. You know, I was at the farm a couple of weeks ago doing some applicating and talking with the team there. And like, it is real. When I'm talking internationally to people over the world, it's easy to forget that sometimes, but it is real. And so I think bringing this as a product and a service that help the rest of the world's companies think about how to do this and bring it to them is also really important. And so I sort of see our growth as like the catalytic buyers are also the most advanced in their own knowledge, their own ability for diligence. We're always close with them and sharing ideas and thinking about how their commitments will help us grow. And then you have the more traditional companies, often more conservative companies. How do we help them get their arms and legs around rock weathering? Mm-hmm. Because it is new, but it needn't be scary.
Yeah. Want to close by talking a bit more about your personal journey or talking about it and to becoming CEO. Congratulations on your appointment. That's very, very exciting. But like you're an electrical and biosystems engineer. You grew up between Western Australia and West Virginia. I've never even heard of anyone who's had that background. That's incredible. You're a recent mother. Congratulations on that as well. And you're working in an industry that can be such a boys club, you know, in terms of like VC and even tech and climate tech even specifically. Like, tell us a bit more about that journey and like what's worked for you, what like big lessons have you learned? What are sort of, you know, those guiding lights of wisdom that you want to share with others as you've made your way?
The connection with Western Australia and West Virginia, which yes, I think there's very few. And most of them are connected by mining, which I'm not really, but I saw two places on opposite sides of the globe that are so similar in terms of the impact that the mining economy has had on them, you know, past, present, future. And that's crazy to me because the world is actually small because of that. Like the way that these communities develop is actually really similar. They're just really far away and the people talk differently and look differently. That was like really fascinating to me. And I think getting into rock weathering brought full circle this idea that there are ways to improve and use industries that already exist to not have to recreate the wheel. But funnily, in like places like Detroit where I live, that automotive was made successful by the fact that there was a huge body of engineering talent here from the furnace and stove industry before auto. And so I think about this, what are the places where there are going to be these working populations of people that need jobs that look like the expertise that they have? And so sectors like agriculture and mining are super interesting industries to me when I think about like, what is the next frontier for these places going to look like? Because that was crazy to kind of like come full circle back to this thing, which I love.
That's so inspiring too, like that these places that like, you know, because industry has left maybe in some cases or, you know, has been depleted, like they're now, you know, the fulcrum by which we could, you know, save the world, you know, and these people, we need these people's skills and
Absolutely. And like, how do you find ways to make that not actually terrifying, because it's actually an incredible opportunity for these places. And it doesn't need to be scary. I think it's just making it, you know, putting it into terms and jobs and shapes that people can understand. But so that's like been a crazy full circle thing. And I love working in this, you know, you mentioned intersection of like tech, science, agriculture. Previously, when I worked in the securities and like federal and government industries, it was like very similar kind of conservative environments in some ways, just interesting corollaries between all. But it's been an amazing journey. I think the biggest thing that I like tell people who are asking how the heck I started doing this is that you can't have a plan. Like you have things that you want to do, but things arise that look differently than you expected. And you sort of have to like read the signals and signs and figure out which way you want to go. And so, you know, I so often think like, if you would have told me 15 years ago, oh, you're going to be thinking about agriculture technology all day, or you're going to be thinking about rocks for carbon removal, like I would have told you, you're totally insane.
Yeah. Same. If someone,
there's like, no way I'm going to be doing that, you know, but like, this is how life goes.
Yeah. Like even like 8 years ago, someone's like, you're going to be running a, you know, digital marketing agency in London, like focused on, you know, like tech for good. I'd be like, what? Like, no, that was not on my radar, but here we are on this podcast with each other.
Life is beautiful in these ways, but no, it's been cool. It's a really interesting journey. I think, you know, we talked about the people elements. I think the coolest part about getting to work kind of at this intersection and tangent lines between some of these really different industries is the ability to bring people together. And so one of the keys in, I've worked on crazy ag tech technologies. What I realized after doing a few of them is that what I love about them is that you're bringing together, in order to build a really magical business, you're bringing together a group of people who not only have probably never been in the same room as one another, but don't speak the same language, don't come from similar backgrounds, are not used to dealing in the ways of the world that the other does every day. And if you can find ways to make those people not only like be okay sitting in the same room as one another, but actually love it and like find common languages to center around problems like climate, which have been, I think, incredibly focusing for people, right? Like people see that they want to make a difference, and it's easy for them to see, I want to take my career in a different direction. And there's not a lot of things that do that speak to us that way. That's like the great gift, is bringing all those people around and saying like, we're not only going to tolerate each other, we're going to find a way to make this crazy thing work. It's crazy.
And awesome. It's just a small thing, just bringing people from totally disparate backgrounds together to solve the most existential crisis facing the human race ever, you know, no big deal. Like, so don't, you know, not just a small challenge. It's give yourself some credit. Like that's incredible.
Ultimately, and it's fun.
Yeah, exactly.
And it has to be. You know, like if you don't love it and you can't sort of like laugh and smile and look at it and say, oh my gosh, we're getting closer, even when things are hard, like nobody wants to work this hard on these hard problems. You got to make it fun.
What's the famous quote? Like, if your revolution doesn't have dancing, like I don't want to be a part of it, so to speak. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, we got it. We're going to save this thing. And that's like kind of for us, the spirit of why we, you know, named the podcast what we did, Tech Can't Save Us, because we get to talk to amazing people like you who are actually like doing the work and doing the saving, but like enjoying themselves along the way. And that's so inspiring. So just want to thank you for what you're doing. Where can folks find out more about your amazing work, Anna, and you know, the good folks at IAM? Where can they find you in the interwebs and support your cause?
We have website at ioncarbon.com, ioncarbon.com. So you always find us, check us out there, updating that. Probably the best places are LinkedIn. So Ion does a pretty good job, not only of posting our own content, but I love to support what's going on in other pathways as well. We're, like you said, very collaborative as an industry. I think there's lots of friends and lots to be learned amongst the pathways. So our LinkedIn is always a good place to kind of see what's up and see what events we're going to be at. But yeah, I welcome people to learn more, and we need to keep more of the good word going out there.
This has been another amazing episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans, talking about innovations in climate tech, enhanced rock weathering, otherwise known as ERW, with Anastasia Pavlovich, CEO of ION. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing. You're saving the planet, and you're having fun while you're doing it. And just big fan of what you're doing over ION. So thanks for your time today.
Thanks. Follow you guys too. Thanks for listening.
And as always, please smash the subscribe button. Give us a shout out. Give us a review, please. We need more reviews. Give us reviews. And hopefully a 5-star rating so we can get more great guests like Anna onto the podcast. So yeah, thanks everyone. And have a good rest of your week.